Introduction to Globalization and the Development of Indonesian Counterinsurgency Tactics. Globalization and the Development of Indonesian Counterinsurgency, first published in the journal Small Wars and Insurgencies in March 2006, summarizes some of the research from my doctoral dissertation, completed in 2000 for the University of New South Wales, on insurgency and counterinsurgency in Indonesia. The full dissertation, available online, is a study of how guerrilla warfare affects individuals and groups at the village level in traditional societies, and was based on extended fieldwork case studies in Indonesia and East Timor. It examines the political power diffusion effect occasioned by both insurgency and counterinsurgency warfare, in which authority flows away from civilian leaders at the level of the central or national state toward local armed leaders and toward the village or tribal level. These leaders, operating at the head of locally powerful armed groups embedded within the society, tend to acquire increasing authority and influence over communities as a conflict progresses, and their authority tends to be greater in proportion to the degree of traditionalism and xenophobia of the population group in question and perceived external threat to it. The effect operates for both insurgents and counterinsurgents, with military forces engaged in counterinsurgency campaigns also tending to decentralize and to forge powerful local partnerships that detach local commanders from central civilian authority but give them great influence with local communities. The dissertation also traced the development of Indonesian counterinsurgency techniques since 1945 and identified the major strengths, weaknesses, and lessons of the unique Indonesian approach. Indonesia fought a protracted campaign against Islamic separatist insurgents, the Darul Islam movement, from which several modern terrorist groups trace their origins, beginning in the 1940s through the 1950s and into the early 1960s. This conflict, although it was larger, bloodier, and more widespread than the Malayan Emergency, the British anti-communist counterinsurgency campaign in the Federation of Malaya during the same period, is not widely known outside Indonesia. This is partly because, as Sebastian Gorka has argued, although there are literally hundreds of examples of insurgency warfare to choose from, the counterinsurgency community tends to draw its canon of case study examples from a much narrower selection, often colonial-era campaigns involving expeditionary forces from Western countries. As Gorka points out, taking too narrow a selection of examples can significantly skew any conclusions drawn from the experience of European colonial powers, post-war reconstruction, or Cold War campaigns. The Indonesian case lies outside this canon, and as a domestic counterinsurgency involving entirely non-Western actors, it is well worth studying as a means to broaden the frame of reference. In response to the threat of Islamist separatist insurgency and terrorism, the Indonesian army developed a unique approach to low-intensity warfare, defeating Darul Islam with remarkable effectiveness. The army applied the same approach in East Timor from 1975, with initial success. Ultimately, however, the technique proved unsuitable to modern conditions and eventually became entirely counterproductive, contributing to Indonesia's loss of East Timor in 1999. Another important factor was the difficulty, as already discussed, that the Indonesians faced in conducting an expeditionary counterinsurgency campaign in East Timor, as against a domestic counterinsurgency in the case of West Java. Until I began the field research for the dissertation, the political effects of low-intensity conflict in Indonesia, including insurgency, guerrilla warfare, and terrorism, upon villages, populations, and military forces, had not been studied in detail by a field researcher working on the ground with insurgent groups, security forces, extremist movements, and local populations. although researchers like Jeffrey Record and Gerald Hickey had conducted seminal studies at the province and village level in Vietnam, and the political scientist Carl D. Jackson had studied the Dar-ul-Islam movement in the context of traditional authority in West Javanese society, an extended case study applying ethnographic field research methods to a population-based assessment of Indonesia's experience of guerrilla warfare had not been attempted. I tried to fill that gap. Counterinsurgency before 9/11. The process of conducting extended residential fieldwork in Indonesia as a serving Australian Army officer is worth discussing in detail in the context of organizational learning and adaptation. The Australian Army is charged with defending an enormous island continent, the sixth largest country in the world, that has only a tiny population of 25 million people, but covers, when its external territories are taken into account, almost one-seventh of the globe. Australia is a classic trade-dependent maritime state with major economic and political partners in the United States, Southeast and Northeast Asia, the Middle East, and Europe. This unique set of circumstances has given rise to a strategic culture of forward defense in which the Australian Defense Force, ADF, because it is several orders of magnitude too small to conduct a passive continental defense of its immense area of responsibility, tends to operate primarily as an expeditionary power projection force in the literal tropical environment of Southeast Asia, and to send expeditionary forces further afield in support of alliance interests. Between 1939 and 1973, for example, the Australian Army was engaged in continuous operations, mainly jungle warfare and counterinsurgency, across the Pacific and Southeast Asia, as well as World War II, the Malayan Emergency, the Borneo Confrontation, and the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Between 1987 and 2001, Australia committed land-based expeditionary forces to Fiji, Namibia, Cambodia, Western Sahara, Somalia, Rwanda, Bougainville, twice, Mozambique, Kuwait, East Timor, and the Solomon Islands. Australia has no Marine Corps, but because of this tradition of rapid expeditionary deployment of light forces in littoral environments, often making use of airborne and amphibious forces, Australian soldiers tend to operate much like Marines, one of many reasons why the Australian Army has long had a very close relationship with the U.S. Marine Corps. Part of this outward expeditionary focus is an emphasis on area studies, languages, and close engagement with regional military forces. Unlike some armed forces that segregate their area specialists into separate professional streams, in the Australian system, every Army officer undergoes language testing before graduating from the Military Academy at Duntroon, and officers are expected to become proficient in regional, that is, Southeast Asian or Pacific languages. In the late 1980s, when I graduated from the academy, language proficiency or a higher degree in Asian studies were requirements for promotion beyond the rank of captain, creating a career-based incentive for such study. Besides this broader pool of baseline regional expertise, the Army selected certain officers for advanced specialized training in regional languages and cultures at the ADF School of Languages. I was one of these, completing a 12-month Indonesian language course after completing my first two tours as a rifle platoon commander, specialist platoon commander, and company second-in-command in a light infantry battalion. Established in 1942 to teach Japanese to Allied intelligence officers, the School of Languages was, at that time, a huddle of buildings on a weather-beaten promontory at Point Cook, Australia's oldest military airfield, southwest of Melbourne. The school is one of the world's great military language colleges, with a proverbially demanding native speaker teaching staff, a curriculum that covers language, cultural and area studies, and a student body drawn from the intelligence, special forces, and military attaché communities. In 1993, when I studied there, it occupied the same run-down Air Force huts where my grandfather had trained as air crew before leaving Australia to fight in New Guinea in World War II. Student pilots in PC-9 trainer aircraft buzzed us, occasionally too closely for their instructors' comfort, as they circuited the airstrip. Nearby hangars dated to 1903. On one of them, a historic dent was preserved, relic of a minor air crash during training by Lieutenant, later Air Marshal Sir Richard Williams, a towering figure in the history of the Air Force and the first military pilot trained in Australia, who led No. 1 Squadron of the Australian Flying Corps in support of T.E. Lawrence during the Arab Revolt, later commanded a wing of the Royal Air Force, and became Chief of Air Staff between the wars. Neither the crash hangar nor the other buildings seemed to have had so much as a lick of paint since my grandfather's time. Southerly winds, straight from Antarctica, according to student myth, though not geographic reality, raked the school for much of the year, only partly masking the smell from the enormous sewage farm next door. Rifle ranges, student pilots, and a jetty for high-speed rescue boats kept things noisy, as well as cold and smelly. The school's most distinguished graduate once called it the outhouses of excellence. After graduating from Point Cook, I did further specialized training in military assistance and advisory work with indigenous irregular troops, and then commanded military advisory teams with Indonesian Special Forces and airborne troops in West Java in 1994 and 1995. It was during this work that I made a network of close contacts in the Indonesian military and local communities in the area, first became aware of the Darul Islam insurgency, and decided to undertake a doctorate in Indonesian counterinsurgency. Another effect of the small size of the ADF is a long-standing emphasis on joint service institutions and operations. The Australian Defence Force Academy, ADFA, where I completed the academic component of my officer training, is a university college of the University of New South Wales, and in addition to training officer cadets of all three services, offers postgraduate degrees to both civilian and military students, including doctorates. I could have applied to take time off from my military duties and attend full-time study at ADFA, but I decided instead to study in my spare time, take no time off from work, and accept no funding from the military. The Defense Academy agreed to take me on as an external part-time student, and throughout the 6 years it took me to complete my doctorate, I spent only a few months at the university campus. Instead, I used my evenings and weekends, my generous annual leave, and the allowance that language-qualified officers receive for independent travel within their target country each year to undertake several periods of extended residential fieldwork in Indonesia. I was also lucky enough to win one of two Dunlop Asia Fellowships awarded each year by the University of Melbourne and the Asia Link Foundation, a generous grant that gave me enough money to conduct fieldwork research in-country without being too badly out of pocket. I spent this time studying insurgents, militias, and activists in Indonesia and Timor, often working alone in remote areas with tribal and community leaders and local people. In the event, I managed to complete two case studies, despite being deployed on three military operations, in Cyprus, Bougainville, and East Timor, during this period. These focused on the Islamic insurgency in West Java between 1948 and 1962, and the guerrilla campaign in East Timor between 1974 and 2000. I also managed to do a limited amount of extra field work in Malaysia and Papua New Guinea to produce a comparative analysis of the Malayan Emergency, the Borneo Confrontation, and the West Papua Campaign. The West Java case study was conducted between June 1995 and December 1996 in Australia, the United Kingdom, Indonesia, and the Netherlands. My initial research concentrated on primary sources in Australian and British archives. In the field phase, I undertook field work in three modules, living in small villages and interacting with local people, including security forces, local populations, and insurgents. The first module comprised oral history interviews in Jakarta, Bandung, Garut, and the surrounding rural sub-districts. The second module consisted of Indonesian language primary source research and interviews in Jakarta and Bandung. The third module was a terrain analysis of the Garut Basin. This included the first-ever ethnographic and geographic survey of areas in West Java affected by Islamic insurgency. I then conducted follow-up interviews, imagery analysis, and statistical analysis in The Hague and at the Rijksinstituut voor Oorlogsdocumentatie, NIOD, the Netherlands Institute for War Documentation in Amsterdam. I received very generous support from the military history section of the Netherlands Army General Staff during this period. The East Timor case study was conducted in 1999 to 2000. Research comprised primary source analysis in Australia and fieldwork in Dili, Balibo, Ermera, and the surrounding district. Fieldwork, again in a small village environment, working through open-ended personal engagement with local communities, participant observations, terrain analysis, and interviews with local people, militia, the Indonesian military, Timorese guerrillas, and UN personnel. I managed to take extensive field notes on terrain, culture, political structure, and military operations using a standard ethnographic methodology based on participant observation and interviews, along with oral combat historical analysis. This case study was and remains the only contemporaneous field analysis of the 1999 International Force in East Timor, INTERFET, campaign. Overall, fieldwork formed the major component of the study, comprising more than 8 months of residential field research and 4,300 hours of interviews in Indonesian, Sundanese, and Tetun, the local language of East Timor. The fieldwork data showed that low-intensity warfare in Indonesia between 1945 and 1999 did indeed demonstrate a political power diffusion effect. This effect was triggered by the outbreak of guerrilla warfare, which itself flowed from crises generated by processes of modernization and change within Indonesian society. These crises were also affected by events outside Indonesia, including invasion by Japan, the Cold War, the Asian financial crisis, and increasing economic and media globalization. They resulted in a breakdown or weakening of formal power structures, allowing informal power structures to dominate. This, in turn, allowed local elites to develop political and military power at the local level while being subject to little control from higher levels. This prompted a process of power diffusion from central and civilian leadership levels to local leaders with coercive means, most often military or insurgent leaders. Having been triggered by guerrilla operations, however, such power diffusion was heavily influenced by contextual variables, of which the most important were geographical factors, political culture, traditional authority structures, and interaction with external events. Topographical isolation, poor infrastructure, severe terrain, scattered population groupings, and influence by traditional hierarchies tended to accelerate and exacerbate the loss of central control. Conversely, good infrastructure, large population centers, good communications, and a high degree of economic and governmental institutionalization tended to slow such diffusion. Moreover, while power might be diffusing at one level of analysis, for example, at the level of the central nation-state, it might also be centralizing at another, for example, into the hands of military leaders at a local sub-national level. The fieldwork also provided a detailed exposition of Indonesia's unique counterinsurgency and counter-terrorist technique. This technique, developed in West Java in the 1950s, was later applied in conflicts all over Indonesia, including East Timor, Irian Jaya, and Aceh. Under the specific conditions of West Java, it was dramatically effective in ending the campaign against Darul Islam after a 12-year stalemate. When applied later in East Timor, the technique was initially successful, but it imposed an adaptational pressure that forced the insurgents to modify their tactics and take their cause to the international community. The inability of the Indonesian military and government to adapt their technique so as to deal with the insurgency under international scrutiny ultimately cost Indonesia the province of East Timor. Indonesia's application of the same technique against sophisticated modern terrorist and extremist groups has also been problematic. In more general terms, the study, summarized in part in the article that follows, shows the growing influence of globalized media, world public opinion, and changing international norms on the conduct of counterinsurgency. As an insight into these processes, and as an example from outside the narrow canon of classical counterinsurgency, the Indonesian case is worthy of detailed examination.